For anyone who hasn't seen The Music Man, we should have just begun by saying it is essentially the monorail episode from The Simpsons.
It's essentially the monorail episode, only it ends with no one dying or monorails destroying a city. But basically the same show.
There's a popular image of a con artist that doesn't exist in the real world. It's an image of a well-dressed, suave, fast-talking swindler who, despite their dodgy dealings, always does the right thing in the end. After all, they have a code. I'm talking about Johnny Hooker and Henry Gorndorff in The Sting, or Danny Ocean and his gang in the Ocean's films, or the casts of shows like Hustle, Leverage, and White Collar. But before all of them was Professor Harold Hill, the title character of Meredith Willson's musical, The Music Man. The story of a small-time con man's attempts to convince the people of River City, Iowa to invest in his non-existent boys band has been a staple of theatre, movies and TV since it premiered in 1957. Just last year, the musical broke box office records when Hugh Jackman starred in a revival. On this episode of Scammapalooza, I talk to theatre maker M. Chandler about why Harold Hill has endured and what about musical theatre makes it the perfect medium for telling a swindler's story. If you enjoy the podcast, tell your friends, share it on social media, or just write a review. It's the only way to get the word out there. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I first watched The Music Man when I was obsessed with con artist movies, and I was slowly making my way through every last one of them. Do you remember the first time you watched it?
Yes. Well, I think as I was rewatching the 62 film, I recall the first time I think I saw it was like it was on TV on a Saturday afternoon or something. We must have started watching halfway through. So I was just watching the school board in their barbershop quartet singing. I remember as a kid going, this is so boring. There's just these four men standing, singing. What's going on? So I didn't really pay attention, and rewatching it, realizing how actually incredible the film is as a recording of the musical and how incredible Robert Preston is as Harold Hill.
Because I guess we should maybe start just by talking about why we're talking about it. Because
that's probably a good idea.
There are a lot of con artist stories and there are also a lot of musicals. But I think for me, what makes The Music Man kind of the ultimate in this stable of con artist musicals is that it really captures that very American idea of the fast-talking swindler who sweeps into town and dazzles everyone with his silver tongue and his little suitcase with his name written on it. And you know, a literal song and dance man. And it's
absolutely. And particularly as Meredith Willson, who wrote the music lyrics, and depending on who you spoke to, either wrote the libretto devising the story someone else or wrote the story himself and wrote the libretto of someone else. It's a bit murky. But anyway, he wrote it as a love letter to the Iowa he grew up in 1912. And so it's this full-on Americana love letter. And of course, Harold, it's one of the few con artist-focused musicals that is original. Like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is an adaptation of a film. You've got now the name is escaping me.
Catch Me If You Can.
Catch Me If You Can, which of course is an adaptation of a film, adaptation of a true life. But Harold Hill is a totally invented person by Meredith Willson, and he's the epitome of this person who just flies into town to change everyone's lives and sweeps out again. And of course, he doesn't sweep out because he falls in love.
Ah, what? Spoilers.
Sorry.
We are going to spoil the musical if you haven't seen it already. But the story is fairly slight. I mean, there's lots of little episodes and little zigs and zags, and characters come and go. But it is, as you said, he comes to town to pull off a scam, falls in love, and decides to not pull the scam and to try and be the thing that he was pretending to be.
Yeah.
Or to do his best to pretend to be it, I should say. And what is he pretending to be? So he sweeps into town to start a boys band?
Yeah, he starts a boys band. He's come in to find that the serious trouble that the town is in, and of course discovers that the town is in no trouble at all whatsoever, so he has to develop the serious problems they've got. So they need a boys band, you know, to protect the purity and good nature of their kids, to have things to do after school with, you know, fancy instruments and instruments as it's repeated with uniforms with a red stripe down the leg. Apparently that was very amazing for people in 1912.
Yeah, but before that, it opens with this extraordinary song that is, I don't know if it counts as a cappella because there's no instruments.
No, so. There's no instruments. Sondheim notoriously would say it's the first moment of rap in a musical, because we would say the witch's rap in Into the Woods is the first rap. He's like, no, Meredith Wilson did Rock Island, opening number of Music Man.
I was going to say that. I wrote that down, and then as I read it, I go, oh, no, that's lame. That's so lame. But it is. It's rap, and it's because it's sort of spoken and rhythmic, but they're not singing.
No, they're recreating the sounds of a steam train moving through their dialogue, discussing their lives as traveling salesmen and then discussing this mysterious figure of Howard Hill. And apart from being an incredible song, it's a bold opening number for a musical in 1950.
Yeah.
Musicals of your big, so we're singing and dancing, and there's like, nope, we're going to have people talk in rhythm for 4 minutes.
It does perfectly introduce the character because throughout the song, they're singing about being some people refer to these guys as con artists, but they're salesmen, right?
They're all salesmen who are realizing that the world is changing, and so they have less jobs now.
Cash for the noggins and the piggins and the frickins.
Cash for the hogshead cask and demijohn. Cash for the crackers and the pickles and the fly paper.
Look, what do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk?
Where do you get it?
What do you talk?
You can talk, you can talk. You can bigger, you can talk. You can bigger, bigger, bigger. You can talk, you can talk. You can talk, 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 talk. Bigger, bigger, bigger. You can talk all you want to, but it's different than it was.
No, it ain't. But you gotta know the territory.
And as they're talking and performing, they get more and more agitated, and then the name of Howard Hill comes in and they start talking about this terrible man performing this horrible scam. This beautiful moment where a man stands up and, goes to leave, and someone says, oh, I didn't catch your name. And he says, I didn't give it. And he grabs down his case and it says Professor Howard Hill. And he's been sitting there amongst them the whole time and disappears onto the train.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. Like, what a great introduction to a character. It's like, he says barely says a word in the song. I don't think he actually says any. He says a couple of words throughout it, right?
It depends on the version. So I think in the 62 film, he doesn't speak. Actually, I think Rob Preston's in the shot for most of the time. I think they sneak him in at the end, hiding behind a newspaper or something. And I think in the Matthew Broderick version, he says a few lines. So it depends on the version. But the most part, it's everyone talking about Hill. And we don't actually get a proper introduction from him himself until You Got Trouble.
Yeah.
Everyone's talking about him prior to that.
But he's there. He's already there. So they're talking about someone and you realize, hang on, this guy's already there. And so straight away you get, this guy is a con artist. He is a swindler, despite the fact it's not a grand scam, just letting people talk about him without him. But we as the audience have been fooled by him within 5 minutes.
Yes. And of course, what part of the also genius is that the song ends and they talk like, oh, yeah, no one dare do anything like that in Iowa. And that's when he's like, well, I'm going to give it a shot. And he stands up and they're like, who are you? And then, reveal on his case, and he walks off into town, pieces punch.
It's the town's name, Riverdale, is that?
River City.
River City. Riverdale is the town from Archie comics, right?
Yeah, from Riverdale.
Right. Riverdale, right. So, River City, excellent. So he arrives in River City, and he sort of starts looking around, and he meets he catches up with an old friend.
Yeah, he ends up meeting Marcellus Washburn, which is one of the incredible names in this show. Lots of incredible names. But Marcellus, who was he's Stooge back when they apparently used to be presumed from when they worked in New York, and Marcellus has settled down, working at a stable, looking after horses, and has fallen off with an Iowan girl and all as well. But Marcellus very quickly steps up to helping Gregory. It's revealed that Howard Hill's not even his real name. He's actually Gregory. And he steps up to help Howard Hill pull this con, which he's done hundreds and hundreds of times before, but now has taken it to the nth degree, complete with costumes and uniforms.
And what is – just about those names. Yeah. As you said, they're the fantastic names. They remind me of the names that Mike Shore, who created Parks and Recreation,
yes,
and The Good Place and those sort of shows. The same thing, just these extraordinary names for the characters. It's that same sort of thing. Like we've got Marion Peru. You've got Marcellus Washburn. You've got I couldn't actually get her name, but it was Shin. Was it like Mayor Shin's wife?
Mayor Shin. I think it's like Eleanor. McKinley Shin or something. They always use names. It's delightful.
Yeah, Olin Britt and Oliver Hicks and all of these fantastic names that just, yeah.
Yeah. And lots of names that we don't like. They're not even used a lot. Like, you know, the four school board members all have fantastic names that we basically never hear, but they're all named and they've all got something to talk about.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the great things about the show is that it isn't, while it's, you know, a handful of main characters and then these huge choruses. I don't know if it was that big when, I don't know if it's that big if you go and see the show live, but there's just dozens of people in almost every song milling around in the background. And it seems like they all have names and characters and personalities. And there's so much depth to these people that they're not just a bunch of rubes. They've all got their own little stories to tell.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a testament to how much it is a love letter for Meredith Wilson, that he's really trying to recreate that, you know, completely filled with nostalgia, the town he grew up in Iowa, down to, you know, every last person having their own personality and obscure references.
You mentioned You've Got Trouble,
yes,
which I believe the correct name is The Monorail Song from The Simpsons.
You've Got Trouble is a better song. The Monorail Song's good, but You've Got Trouble's better.
Sure, okay. But The Monorail Song from The Simpsons is the original song, and this is just a weak imitation.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It glides as softly as a cloud. Is there a chance the track could bend? Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
What about us Brendan slobs?
You'll be given cushy jobs.
Were you sent here by the devil?
No good, sir, I'm on the level.
The ring came off my pudding can.
Take my penknife, my good man. I swear it's Springfield's only choice. Throw up your hands and raise your voice.
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
Once again.
Monorail. For anyone who hasn't seen The Music Man, we should have just begun by saying it is essentially the monorail episode.
It's essentially the monorail episode, only it ends with no one dying or, you know, other towns in destitute and monorails destroying a city.
That is true.
Basically,
yeah.
The same show. Yeah.
Yeah, and Conan O'Brien, who wrote the monorail episode, loves The Music Man and that kind of show.
He adores it. In fact, he was asked to step into the role of Harold Hill, and I think it's like this 2000 revival or 2001 revival, and he had clashing commitments and had to turn it down. And his quote is saying, like, it was like, it's the biggest decision I've ever had to make to not play Harold Hill.
He would be amazing as Howard Hill. Oh, my God. Extraordinary. I don't know if he can sing, but who cares? No, he's musical.
He barely has to sing. Like, you're the spoken.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the song You've Got Trouble is fantastic because it does, as you said, it introduces the character, but it also does, it demonstrates how adept a con artist he is. He isn't just someone who comes in and says, you should buy band uniforms and musical instruments, but the song is just him sowing the seeds of discontent in this very happy town.
Absolutely.
Convincing them that maybe things aren't going as well as they could be.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think apart from how very skilled the lyric writing the song demonstrates that, but it's the fact that the end of You've Got Trouble, he actually doesn't say, so by the way, get a boys band. Like, that's a different song.
I loved that. What is the cause of the strike? A pool table, a new pool table has arrived.
Either you've closed your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you're not aware of the caliber of disaster notified by the presence of a pool table in your community. Because apparently the town has had a billiards parlor and the billiards, but no table.
Yeah, and it's perfectly acceptable for adults, of course, to use the table, but children will be led into a life of sin and listening to jazz and reading
ragtime
and reading dime novels if they don't. Like, and that fantastic, you know, wait a minute, are your children? And then lists a whole lot of fairly ordinary things children do. Oh, then I'm so, you know, you're in trouble.
We got trouble.
Oh, we got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here in River City.
With a capital T and that rhymes with P and that stands for pool.
That stands for pool.
We surely got trouble.
We surely got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here.
Remember the Maine, Plymouth Rock, and the Golden Rule.
Our children, children, trouble.
Oh,
trouble, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble. That game with the 15 numbered balls is the devil's tool.
Devil's tool!
Oh, yes, we got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble, we've got big, big trouble.
With a T!
With a capital P!
That rhymes with P!
That rhymes with P!
It stands for pool!
That stands for
Remember, my friends, listen to me because I passed this way but once!
I noticed that when the characters are, there's sort of a difference between the songs, which are a performance. The orchestra comes in and you get lots of music, lots of dancing. Everything becomes theatrical. But there are, throughout it, when people are just talking about things or gossiping or just living their lives, there's a lot of those songs that just kind of use the, you know, little, you know, it's a cappella, like the Barbershop Quartet, or there's a bit of the train noises, or there's a whole song that compares gossiping women to chickens.
There's diegetic and non-diegetic songs.
That's the word I was looking for, yes. The
diegetic is when, like, so Shapoopy, which is the big dance number in Act 2, it's a diegetic, like, we all know we're singing a song, we're all doing a dance, we know that we're singing. And the Barbershop Quartet songs, you could say, are the same thing. But then there are ones like The Piano Lesson or You Got Trouble, which are non-diegetic, so they're songs for us as audience, but they're not for the characters in world. They're just having a chat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the diegetic ones are the ones in which most if not all of the music and the sounds come from the environment. So
yes.
There could be instruments, but they have to be instruments that exist within the scene itself. They can't just be that musical sounds coming in from
Or at least conceivably from within the world itself, you know,
might be
for us as audience. But, you know, it's not like, oh, we're hearing a banjo being played and they're clearly playing a piano.
Oh, great. So that's, I mean, that really sets up nicely. It just shows it's showing the listener, the audience, like, hey, this is when you can trust him and this is when you can't, or this is when you're being dazzled and this is when you're being kind of told the truth?
Absolutely. And there's also, because Meredith Willson didn't just write The Music Man, he wrote three other musicals. He wrote The Unsingable Molly Brown, which is probably the closest thing he has to his other hit. He wrote Here's Love, which was retroactively retitled Meredith Willson's Miracle on 34th Street, because it's an adaptation of Miracle on 34th Street. And he wrote a musical, which was not very successful, 1491, I think, which is about Christopher Columbus. But in all his work, he loves counter melodies. He loves songs that interlope together. And so, in fact, his biggest hit outside of The Music Man is It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas, which he put into Here's Love and wrote a different song that is a counter melody to it for a different character. And in The Music Man, there's lots of counter melodies that end up sitting together. So Pick a Little, Talk a Little, which is the women, town folk, towns, women's gossiping, is a counter melody to Goodnight Ladies, which the Barbershop Quartet sings. It's rumored that My White Knight, which Marion the Librarian sings, is a counterpoint to Sadder But Wiser Girl, which is Howard Hill's song about, you know, the sort of woman he wants to fall in love with. And of course, 76 Trombones, which is Howard Hill's sort of theme, is exactly the same melody as Goodnight My Someone, which is Marianne's longing, only in different time signatures. So there's lots of these, not pigeonholing, but sort of leaving little breadcrumbs for the audience to realize the different connections and overlapping stuff that's going to happen, whether it's the skills of his con artistry or the romantic relationships that are going to emerge, just through the music.
And so it's showing him going from being an outsider, you know, putting on a show, and to sort of getting himself entangled in the lives of these people. Like musically entangled. There is a song, I think it's about Lydia, is that right? I'm going from memory now. It's one of the songs the Barbershop Quartet sings, and in the film it's literally, you see a split screen between them and Marion.
As Isla Rose or Isla Rose or something, but
you see
them, and then they literally go, look, they're the same song, so they sit together.
So it's interesting to see that, watching it as he's sort of sown these seeds of discontent and then starts to convince the town folk that this band is going to be the way forward. I got real sort of Invasion of the Body Snatchers vibe of just watching him. He didn't do it, you know. Usually, I would imagine this would be done in one song probably a montage where they just, I mean, the monorail song, yeah, everyone gets won over in the end of the song. But in this, there are skeptics, there are people, there's a problem, how are we going to solve it? And the musical spends a good hour of just him going from, you know, person to person and having these little songs, these little engagements, these little back and forths where he's trying to get them on his team.
Yeah.
And it does, it feels like a horror movie in the sense of that he's like, up, there's another one, he's got another one, and up, yep, they're not going to escape, up, they're sucked in. But some escape, you know, some people, yes, sort of get wise, but then he brings them back again. And there's a real sort of snowballing feeling as more and more people get involved. Absolutely. In the scam.
Absolutely. Well, particularly like Mayor Shin, who's probably the closest thing to a main antagonist that we've got. Like there's a point where Howard Hill convinces him that he's, you know, his pinky finger is just the right amount of movement, that his son is going to be, you know, the world's best flugelhorn player, yes, the first one. And Mayor Shin is like, oh yes, I'm going to pay the money. And as he gets, you know, money out, realizes he doesn't have a son.
Yeah.
But Howard Hill's just, you know, that conniving that somehow for a brief moment, Mayor Shin was going to pay to have his non-existent son in this boys band.
What is great about that character is that, I think it, and it seems like a trick, because it seems like a tricky character to play, because it's tempting to make that kind of guy an idiot. Like he's, yes, he's got the, like the town has elected this blowhard moron to, you know, and it's the blind leading the blind, but he's actually a very kind, thoughtful, he's a real public servant. He's quite, you know, learned. When people say, hey, you're being scammed, he's like, wait, you're right, I am being scammed. You know, he's not an idiot. And it's, and as you said, like he feels like a worthy adversary for Hill throughout the film. Like you do feel like he might be about to run him out of town at any minute.
Yeah, and in fact he does almost do that at the end. It's just because when Howard Hill is finally like, I'm not gonna leave, I'm gonna stay here, and he gets caught and you're brought in front of the whole town, that he starts conducting the boys band, which is atrocious. Like the instruments arrive, they're all in their uniform, it's a ghastly bombardment cacophony of noise, but because the townsfolk have been so inspired by the joy of the anticipation, then they start playing out, there's my Barney, who's clearly not playing the clarinet well, but you know, they're just so enraptured. That's the only thing that saves Howard Hill, otherwise he'd probably be imprisoned. Shin only loses because the townsfolk are so enraptured with their children playing instruments terribly.
Yeah, it's one of the things I notice is that as it goes on, and it's difficult to talk about without sounding pat and oversimplifying it, is that as the story progresses, he seems to, you sort of realize that the reason why he's so good at this, and I think it's a line where he sort of says, oh, I always picture the band, where he talks about, yeah, picturing the band in his head, and the little boy says, what band? What are you talking about? There is no band. And he's like, well, there is in my head. And it's that sort of, he's really imagining this as real. And yeah, that's how he's able to pull this off. And it kind of shows that at the beginning, when he happily kind of accepts the moniker of con artist by, you know, not defending himself in the train carriage, that you realize, oh, actually, he's not really being entirely truthful with us there, that he is one of those kind of people who's more of an imposter, who's like, I wish I could do that, but, you know, I'll fake it. That's the best I can do.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the first things Marcellus says to him is, you know, he says, like, how long are you in town? He's like, oh, 4 weeks. And Marcellus says, like, but it takes 10 days to get the instruments. And he's like, no, but it takes 4 weeks to get the uniform. So he's expanded his con to get bigger and bigger and bigger. He clearly actually wants to be able to make a boys band, make marching bands, and relishes in it, but just apparently has a lack of musical ability, despite the fact he managed to teach the school board to be a barbershop quartet in approximately 30 seconds.
Let's talk about the love interest. Let's talk about Marion, who, yeah, and this is Shirley Jones. I didn't recognize her at all.
Yes. Shirley, yeah, Jones and Barbara Cook are both people who have played Marion Peru, the town librarian.
Christian Chenoweth as well.
Yes.
She was in the TV one. Yeah. I've got IMDb up in front of me. I'm not just
cheating.
Pulling this.
You're not cheating.
I'm not cheating. Yeah, I'm cheating. Yes. Yeah. What do you make of that character? Because I have to admit, I was not that. I found her, I mean, I guess she's supposed to be a little cold. I wasn't quite sure why he fell in love with her, to be honest. She was kind of dull and a little uptight, and I just didn't really, I don't know, why does he fall in love with her?
That's a good question. Well, I think Howard Hill is as much as surprised that he falls in love with her as anything else, because sort of just winning over the local piano teacher is sort of just part of the con to convince everyone of his musical ability. And there's a point near the end, I can't tell you the exact song, but then near the end where he's like, oh, bother, I've actually fallen in love with her. And I suspect the reason why is that, firstly, she was so hard to get, so it was just, you know, that's the sort of thing that he likes. But then she actually truly believes in it, because she sees the impact, the potential of this boys band has on her younger brother Winthrop, with the terrible lisp, and how, you know, he's suddenly talking with everyone and is being quite sociable because of the potential of playing cornet in this boys band. And so that's, even if it's going to be crap, that enough sort of won her over, and that sort of that belief in Howard Hill's actual ability to do something genuine, I think, sort of makes the tide change.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah,
it's. I feel like the reason this works so well as a musical, as opposed to any other way of telling this type of story, is that, like, obviously it's about music, so you know that it helps. But I think, and it's something that seems very true of musicals, that the songs. So my understanding of a musical is that when characters break into song, it is a way for them to show the audience what they are thinking and how they are feeling, and of course to show each other, but to show things, to show complex emotions, complex thoughts, complex ideas in a way in which you can't do in regular dialogue. You know, like having a character who is a liar able to actually tell you what he's really thinking, and you believe him, song is the best way to do it. Is that why this works so well?
I think so. And I think it's also because the whole show is so steeped in this nostalgia for an America gone by. Well gone by when Meredith Wilson wrote it in the late 40s, and certainly now. And this idea of, you know, patriotism and boys bands, and, you know, we sing and there's town songs and stuff, that's something that's so steeped in it that it does seem like the only natural way to do it. And, of course, as you've said, the multi-layeredness of musicals, that, you know, what's the saying? When you can't speak, you sing. When you can't sing, you dance. The only way to sort of show this multi-layered of all the townsfolk, actually, but particularly Harold and Marion, is for them to sing.
Yeah, there is a cynicism, I think, though, that that for me creeps in that sense of, as you said, it's this, it's Meredith Wilson having nostalgia for his childhood, and so often with nostalgia, then it's nostalgia for something that doesn't actually exist.
Yes.
You know, that Iowa was never like that, and the small town that he's talking about never really existed. And that's not a criticism of Meredith Wilson or America, but just sort of the nature of nostalgia is, you know, when you watch that TV show from when you're a kid, it's not quite the same later on. And that sense, though, that these kind of musicals reinforce those kind of realities. They say, hey, look, it is real, because look, here it is up on the stage. And the older it gets, the older the musical gets, the more like the truth it starts to feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by no means quote me on this, but I have a recollection, at least an imagined recollection, that, you know, The Music Man is Donald Trump's favorite musical because it's all about this, you know, this America gone by that no longer exists. And of course, Meredith Wilson was aware of that. This whole show is littered with anachronistic references. You know, Captain Willie's Whiz Bang wasn't published till like a decade after the musical is set, before 76 Trombones, when Howard Hill's listing, you know, the famous band he was part of, which of course is fictional in the world, well, was also fictional in real life, because none of those different band leaders could have all been performing at the same time. Like, one of them was dead, one of them was only 6 years old. Like, it's all completely fabricated. And so it's, I mean, there were very mixed reviews of the most recent production, which had Hugh Jackman and Sutton Foster. And part of it was that sort of that glowing shine of America past that doesn't really exist. And is this the best way to actually think about who they are as a country, I guess?
And Is that where we get that idea of the American theater, and particularly the American musical, being kind of a place for myth making, where that very American idea of the patriotism, but the idea of the small town America and apple pie and all of those sort of ideas of their identity, but it does always feel very performative and very theatrical. Looking in from the outside.
Absolutely. I mean, Mary's Son has been incredibly clever with how the whole thing is shut, but it's a fairly standard book musical in terms of, its structure. Even if you've got sort of clever musical overlappings and, Rock Island being the incredible opening where it is. But of course, the Music Man original production won the Tony for Best Musical over West Side Story.
Wow.
Yeah, and if you think about it now, one of a West Side Story, which has had two musical remakes, both have been very successful, and has multiple productions on Broadway and is regularly revived. But which one is sort of the more American myth? Well, it's the one that is set in small town Iowa in 1912, not the one about racial gangs who are trying to work over their differences and, ends in death.
Yeah, and I guess those sort of awards, the Oscars always, like the Academy Awards love giving Oscars to movies and shows about show business and theatre and self-reflective type sort of things. I've just looked it up, so I don't know if The Music Man is his favourite musical, but apparently according to Donald Trump's former press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, one of his aides was nicknamed The Music Man, although his real name was Max Miller, and he was responsible for playing Trump his favorite show tunes. And whenever he got angry or upset, people would say, quick, get The Music Man in here. And he would come, there would be like, they would be coming in and play him songs. Apparently, he was a particular fan of the ballad Memory from Cats. So
somehow that doesn't surprise me. But, that's almost as good as if it was his actual favorite.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I spoke with Tori Toeffler, who's an American writer, and we were talking about an American con artist who went by the name of Cassie Chadwick, and she claimed to be the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, the billionaire industrialist. And we were talking, and this story sort of happened around the same time that The Music Man is set. She talked about how this time period, whereas a lot of these ideas of American identity were first formed, and where the idea of fake it till you make it, the putting on a show, the kind of the gloss, the marketing, the first grew, and that people who were, the con artists or people who were able to really dazzle an audience were the people who did well, and the people who were able to succeed in America at that time. Ooh. So it sort of feels like, even though this was written 50 years later, that it is, I guess, trying to capture that idea of trying to make something even if the thing you're making doesn't really exist.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, at the very least, you can see that through the history of The Music Man. I mean, first Meredith Wilson, I don't know who, but, approached someone about doing it as a telemovie, and then trying to do it as a film, and then wrote something like 30 different attempts in trying to get it off, and then finally got it as a musical.
That's normal for musicals, though, isn't it? My impression is that there's a lot of, I don't know if it's that much, but there's a lot of writing and rewriting.
There's generally a lot of writing, but at least in my minimal experience, you're generally going, well, I'm going to write a musical. Let's get it on stage. So the fact that he was like, well, first let's try a telemovie and then let's try a film. Like, he was just sort of desperate to tell this story. And I think, I don't know, I haven't had the chance to read his biography, Big on Another Territory, which is about writing The Music Man. With the little knowledge I know, I would anticipate that, the more you're trying to tell this story of nostalgia and of past and fake it till you make it, and of music, the more the music sort of became a vital part that wasn't just you can have barbershop quartets and a marching band song, that you have to actually start making songs. And in fact, you can see that with You Got Trouble, which was originally dialogue that he thought he had to cut because it was too wordy. And then he realized he would make a very good lyric, and a very good lyric it did make.
That that sort of idea of like, oh, I haven't got room for dialogue, so I'm going to turn it into a song. Hang on, doesn't that just make it longer? Doesn't that make it take up? I guess you can sing it. You can, in this musical in particular, you can certainly sing things a lot faster than you can say them.
You can certainly sing things a lot faster. And like, as we talked about earlier, when you make something a song rather than spoken text, it changes the way we as the audience approach it. So suddenly it's no longer just a sort of a lengthy scene where he's trying to convince everyone. You've got the vim and vigor of him riling up the crowd to go, yes, we've got trouble in this town and we're going to have to do something about it. We don't know what. That's a lot more powerful as song than just someone monologuing for about 4 minutes saying, but there's a pool table. Isn't this dangerous?
Fair enough. Actually, I think, I mean, the amount of history, American history, that Hamilton squeezes into fairly significant runtime, but it's just every lyric and every line has got some sort of reference to a cabinet meeting or a, you know, a war hero and so on that just keeps going and going. So that, yeah, makes sense. So when the musical came out, was it a big hit straight away when it first hit Broadway?
It was a reasonably big hit. I mean, Robert Preston left the production and then came back after a while.
So Robert Preston, because we sort of rushed over it before, Robert Preston, who is the star of the film, he originated the role on Broadway, is that right?
He originated the role on Broadway and repeated it in the film. And he also, if you know the film Victor of Victoria, he plays Toddy in Victor of Victoria, but was not known as a singer. He sort of got the audition, but when he got into the audition, he claims everyone was trying to sing You've Got Trouble, and he just approached it as a spoken monologue in rhythm and, you know, smashed it out of the ballpark. And so despite not necessarily, he doesn't have a bad voice, but not being the world's greatest singer, got the part, which probably makes sense because Howard Hill is, you know, a quick talker, not necessarily your fine soprano or tenor in your opera company.
But that's why you have Christian Chenoweth and Shirley Jones and people like that who can actually carry a tune, because they're like extraordinary singers compared to him. Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, you know, the countermelodies go over that you've got, just, you know, him basically giving rhythm and them doing these lovely, glorious high notes.
Excellent. And the film was also a hit as well, straight away.
It was. I can't tell you exactly how much it made or anything, but, you know, it wasn't a flop by any stretch. It was well received.
It seems to me there are not very many musicals from that era, from the 1950s, because it's a 1950s musical, that are still in production today. Hugh Jackman recently had a revival on Broadway of The Music Man. Are there any other shows that have that sort of longevity that people just keep coming back to?
Well, it's one of those questions of longevity for your lay people versus your music theatre people. But at least, you know, from my limited knowledge, the two musicals I can think of the, 1951 or 1952, that still stick out is The Music Man and West Side Story. They're sort of the only two that I would go, well, yes, random people in the audience or random people in the crowd are going to at least have a vague knowledge of.
There's a ton of movies, obviously, movie musicals from the 50s, but musicals that are still being, you know, like you're not getting productions of these. I don't know, I mean, it's maybe The King and I guess that's one that people keep coming back to.
Certainly outside your Rodgers and Hammersteins, because they sort of become this canon of shows we're going to keep doing forever. Music Man is a standout, and by miles and miles, Music Man is Meredith Wilson's most well-known work.
Before we wrap it up, can we talk about some of the other great sort of con artists of, and swindlers and liars and cheats from musicals? Because I feel like they do There seems to be a lot of them. Obviously, you mentioned Catch Me If You Can, and also Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, both turn into musicals. There's the producers. I mean, they're a pair of con artists.
They're a pair of con artists. That wasn't necessarily their main job, but you know, they did a very big con that was a big flop.
Yeah, Oliver, I guess we could call that one.
It would just also be questions of, you know, are we defining con artists and musicals as their profession, like it is in Howard Hill, or is it something that they do? Because if it's something that happens, you could switch that to Evan Hansen and Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah, yes. Well, I mean, because Dear Evan Hansen, I haven't seen that. That is the one about a 40-year-old man pretending to be a teenager. No, I know. But that's the one where they recently had a film where the actor, whose name escapes me right now, was way too old for the role and just looks like he's 40 walking around with teenagers.
It's not a good look. He did originate the role on Broadway, much like Robert Preston did, but there is something to be said about originating a role in, you know, anywhere between your mid-30s to mid-50s and then repeating that on film versus I was a teenager and now I'm in my 30s.
Yeah, that's right. That was a scam they couldn't get away with. Barnum, that's got to – I mean, like, obviously Barnum the musical is not – he's not really – he's a song and dance man in that. He's less of a con artist than Howard Hill. Would you say in Barnum the musical he's not quite as – I mean, he's not a con artist in that film?
Well
– in that musical?
Yeah, he's probably not painted as a con artist, but it wouldn't be at all wrong to read through that because he is still pulling the odd scam here and there, trying to, you know,
do
the best show. But it's certainly more of a positive light, even though, you know, Howard Hill ends up in a positive light. He's clearly pulling something that, you know, unnecessary and possibly disastrous. Barnum is painted in a much more positive light from the get-go.
I suppose to me, Barnum, the real Barnum was a con artist and a fairly horrible man. So is it Annie? That is not about con artists, but that definitely has con artists playing a large role in the
absolutely. And of course, if you're doing more adaptations, Big River, which is the adaptation of Huckleberry Finn. Has the Duke and the King, who are con artists.
Yeah. Oh, Les Mis.
Les Mis, of course.
Master of the House. Yeah. So why are there so many con artists? Is it just there are just so many musicals and everyone loves a good con artist, and or is there something specific about con artists that make them good characters to plonk in your musical?
I think it's probably just because they're just good stories. It's probably the real answer. But I think a more interesting answer would be that because, particularly if we're looking at sort of, you know, Dear Evan Hansen and Howard Hill, it gives you a very easy plot to start adaptating and very easy twists and turns for a story where you have to juggle the person with their lie versus what everyone knows and how they're going to court out. And that can make very interesting theatre to watch. And particularly when you've got the multi-layered narrative ability of the musical as a form. When you can't speak, you sing. You can't sing, you dance. That's like layers and layers of cons. The deeper you get, the more interesting and nuanced things become. So it's probably not a deliberate choice by those of us who are writing musicals to have con artistry as a surprisingly high theme, but it's probably not an accident either.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I should bring you back to talk about every other musical that we have just mentioned one after the other and do a whole series, because I could talk about these shows for years.
Happily.